How do you roll out the impending wave of artificial intelligence in a way which is trusted, which is accepted, which is understood by the people that are both using them or being impacted by them? I think the first thing that you need to understand about socially responsible AI is that it needs to follow some recognized code of ethics.
Hello, I'm Bruce Berman, the host of Understanding IP Matters, a podcast series that looks at the impact of intellectual property rights on people and business. Season 3 spotlights such topics as artificial intelligence, IP licensing, and TikTok as a learning tool. Enjoy the episode. It may come as a surprise that many educators who teach intellectual property rights are not particularly fond of them. An increasing number of law school professors believe that patents are overreaching, others that copyright term of up to 95 years is too long, and that AI bots should be allowed to collect content license-free. How are IP rights being presented to the next generation of lawyers? On today's episode of Understanding IP Matters, we look at preparing future lawyers for an AI world where IP rights are literally everywhere and nations like China and big tech companies believe they can use them with impunity. What do future lawyers need to know today? Can graduates dubious about IP rights effectively represent owners and investors? Today's guests are leading educators who focus on teaching about invention rights and copyrights that protect creative expression. Daryl Lim is an award-winning author and commentator on IP rights and competition policy. He's endowed chair in law and an associate dean for research and innovation at Penn State Dickinson School of Law. Daryl is also an affiliate at Penn State's Center for Socially Responsible Artificial Intelligence and a frequent speaker. His views on legal developments have been featured in Forbes, The Washington Post, Bloomberg, The Hill, and USA Today. Megan Carpenter is dean and professor at the University of New Hampshire's Franklin Pierce School of Law. Megan is an internationally known expert in intellectual property with interests in entrepreneurship, branding, and the arts. Megan has spearheaded the creation of innovative academic programs, including experiential learning initiatives, joint degree programs, and interdisciplinary programs. She is author of Evolving Economies, The Role of Law in Entrepreneurship and Innovation. Welcome today. Thank you for being with us. Where are you located today? Megan, you're up in New England, are you not?
I am actually in, we have a place in the Shenandoah Valley, and our older son is in the Coast Guard and has limited time off. So he has a few days before Christmas and needs to report in on Christmas Eve. So we're shifting everything and spending a few days together.
Daryl, where are you today?
Well, Bruce, like Megan, I've decamped for the holiday season. I am in Chicago. Very pleased to join the both of you.
Great. Well, it's great to have you. You both focus on teaching IP rights. How is that different from teaching other topics like criminal law, corporate law? Megan, let's start with you.
Oh, that's such a good question. One of the things I always tell students is that, you know, they will see so much progression in the law over time if they're focused on IP, that when they graduate, I mean, when I think about, you know, the time that I graduated from law school and, you know, the cases we were reading in the trademark space, I remember were, you know, that when I was first practicing, they would say things like, you know, well, both companies advertise on the internet, so there must be some kind of likelihood of confusion. Think about sort of where we've come in the last 20 years plus in sort of in the IP space and kind of as the law has evolved. And, you know, of course, students graduating right now will see similar, you know, development and evolution and significant change. Every week, there's something different. IP is all about kind of the legal framework surrounding human invention and creativity. And that just is, you know, not only a phenomenally interesting intellectual exercise, but one that keeps us on our toes every single day.
Daryl, how do you see the difference between teaching IP and other areas of law?
Well, I usually start by telling students that this is one area of law that's pretty much recession-proof. And they perk up and say, oh, we're going to have jobs after we graduate. So they're happy. The law schools are happy. The second thing I tell them is that the things that they study in class are typically things that you're going to be reading about in the newspapers. And so it touches our lives, as Megan had put it, in so many different ways. So it's not an abstract subject. It's really something that's intimately intertwined to particularly our social generation, social media generation these days. And so they understand this intuitively. And the third thing I'd say is it's really international in nature, given how interconnected we are in the world. For people who are cosmopolitan minded, this is really an exciting opportunity for them to be plugged in just by nature of what they do, because the laws in so many parts of the world are very similar to those in the United States. And you can kick up a conversation very easily in all these international IP organizations that people in the profession are part of. And it really enriches, I think, the practice of law.
Darryl, what's the typical law school curriculum today for someone interested in IP rights? What are the requirements?
Well, I think it really depends on which school you're in. And the school that I was from recently, the school that Megan is heading, has a very deep and rich IP curriculum. And I think it goes back decades. And I've come to appreciate that you need to have a deep bench in order to sustainably offer courses that go into the not just specialties, but sometimes sub-specialties, and then generations of alums and contacts that continually give back and enrich that curriculum. So once you have that in place, you can really offer students a full suite of courses. Most law schools are not like that. Most law schools, I think, are more broadly focused, and it's a strategic decision. I think more law schools increasingly recognize the importance of IP and technology, and you talked about AI, and so they're getting into the game. But the first movers have an advantage, and I think the first movers are now at the point where they are thinking about how do you broaden into new markets. Megan, for example, I saw on social media recently, was just back from Mexico, and there's tremendous opportunities in some of these emerging economies, in the Middle East, in some parts of Asia, in India. So I think that the courses are evolving, the students are evolving, the markets are evolving. So it's an exciting time also to be an educator in IP.
What about the lawyers who don't focus on IP? Are they exposed to intellectual property law? Is it through contracts, or are there specific courses for them?
I'll refer back to what Darryl said about, you know, sort of depending upon what law school you attend. So, you know, at Franklin Pierce, IP is kind of the core focus of our curriculum. So all of our first year students either choose to take kind of the fundamentals of intellectual property law or a more practical civil law kind of focused class that's a smaller course. So our first year students, it's not typical among law schools in the United States, but all our first year students, the majority of them have exposure to IP in that very first year. So whatever they end up practicing, they have a kind of, you know, some basic understanding of the main food groups of IP and some emerging issues. I do think that probably, and I'd be interested, I bet Darryl has experienced this as well. I've led IP programs at schools where I was the only intellectual property professor, and then, you know, have been one of many. And I think wherever, you know, especially when you're kind of a lone wolf out there, you're getting a lot of questions from other professors, because increasingly casebooks are starting to incorporate, whether it's in property or criminal law or tax, things that have to, you know, cases that center around IP issues. So you'll get those inquiries of like, will you come and guest lecture in our class? Or, you know, how should I approach this particular issue? And so over, you know, the course of time, I think I've seen more and more other doctrinal areas incorporate IP as part of their, you know, essential structure. But Darryl, I'd be curious. I bet that probably reflects your experience.
Because Penn is not specifically focused on IP.
Right. So Penn State Dickinson Law is not focused on IP specifically, but I think it's very active in the AI space. And so when I was hired, that was in fact one of my charges. Please come and help us to develop the connection with AI. And because AI lends itself to interdisciplinary education, to your question, Bruce, it's not just the law students that are now thinking about technology and IP, it's the non-law students. There's a huge market for that, and we need to approach the education of IP more broadly, I think, than we have in the past. And I'd say you've seen this almost as a revolution in the last 5 years, and we have got online opportunities, I think, in a way that we didn't think about before the pandemic. And so when we think about how do you link IP to civil procedure, how do you link IP to contracts, how do you link IP to management theory, how do you link IP to engineering, it becomes more of learning how to adapt what you have to continue to make it relevant. And I think that's really an underappreciated, overlooked area in legal education. And those that can tap onto this opportunity, I think, will be ahead in the game. Forget about US news rankings and forget about traditional advantages. I think this is a new economy where people that can offer the goods will get ahead.
Interesting. You want to add something, Megan?
You know, one of the things that I think we are starting to see, but there is huge opportunity, is in the undergraduate space. It's absurd to me that, you know, in a typical undergraduate education, you have to take, you know, a certain number of science classes, certain, you know, liberal arts classes to kind of get your program of education. But in general, there is no requirement in most universities that you need to take a class focused on kind of the legal frameworks within which you live your life every single day. And so I think law schools have been, you know, somewhat to, you know, our own fault and the fault of our accreditor, but I mean, somewhat isolationist and have not kind of looked at legal education in a broad sense. But I think there is a need, not just in for what you're talking about in the context of the legal education for professional graduate education, but also in undergraduate education and increasingly in public high school education.
I think in Colorado, they were talking about putting some IP instruction or awareness of IP in the civics curriculum for high school students. And I think they were heading in that direction. But, you know, CIPU, a few years ago, we did a survey of business schools, the top 20 U.S. business schools. You may be aware of this. And we found that none of them have required IP courses. These are the top 20: Stanford, Columbia, Berkeley, Harvard. And I think only a third had regular courses. You know, some had periodic courses, but none had required courses, which I find pretty amazing. I mean, you're graduating as an MBA, you're going to be in finance, you're going to be managing big companies. What are you managing? What happens then is you learn when you get burned. There's a problem, and then you have to learn quickly. As I'm sure you're aware, increasing number of law school professors are not that fond of strong IP rights. They may believe that patents are overreaching, that software is unpatentable. To what do you attribute this perspective, and do you believe it's of consequence to the future of IP rights? Megan, let's start with you.
That's something that I think a lot about, because I hear a lot from our alumni about that, you know, sort of the shifting nature of IP education, and they want to make sure that, you know, our curriculum just sort of reflects, you know, a recognition of the value of intellectual property rights within our system.
I would think your school would be certainly pro-IP and pro-strong rights. So it's maybe a bit of an anomaly. But I think in general in law schools, I don't know, Daryl, what's your experience?
I think you see it to be trendy to bash IP in law schools. And there's something about it that resonated, I think, more strongly with the Napster, the Kazaa generation, where it was difficult or expensive to get access to what have you, music, movies. And so the idea that you're almost having this civil disobedience by accessing pirated material seemed to resonate with the students, and the faculty espoused a particular doctrine. I think that has shifted in some ways in the copyright space. I think you're more towards the center now. Where I'm very concerned about is in the patent space. And I was just having a conversation with Suzanne Harrison, who served as chair of PPAC. And this is public. In fact, it's on YouTube, so I'm not giving away any secrets. And she just shared her concern about whether or not patents will continue to be seen as legitimate and relevant, not in the next 10 years, but you know, in a few coming years. And I was surprised to hear that. And she's right there in the trenches where she can actually get a good sense of what's going on. I think there's something to be said about stakeholders really looking at the system and seeing why has it lost its legitimacy? And what is it that, in the same way that in the copyright and trademark spaces, we move things back to an ethos where IP rights are respected. Are we missing something? Are the judges missing something? Are the government officials missing something? Are the law professors missing something? What kind of behavior are we rewarding? And how are we going about the messaging? I think there's a lot of deep thinking that needs to be done. And so through organizations like the US IP Alliance, Trubar associations, and so on, I think this really is a collective effort. It's a challenge of our generation. We take it as given that medicines and new technologies are just going to sprout out of the ether. Well, that doesn't quite happen that way. But it's difficult for, I think, a lot of people to imagine the counterfactual. And so the vital margin rights, well, we see that now used in a way, right, that we would not have imagined before. What's driving it? You see that the FTC is being very muscular in its approach. So you think that a lot of things have settled. We have arrived, but I think in many ways, we're just beginning to reimagine and reaffirm what IP law is all about.
Sure. I mean, for the so-called unicorns, if they're internet, e-commerce, or software related, they could have no patents or very few. They're just not thinking about them. Maybe down the road, if they get big enough, they will. Daryl, you're an affiliate at Penn State's Center for Socially Responsible AI. I love that sound of that. How do you define socially responsible artificial intelligence? What are you focusing on over there?
Well, that's again another challenge of our generation. How do you roll out the impending wave of artificial intelligence in a way which is trusted, which is accepted, which is understood by the people that are both using them or are being impacted by them? I think the first thing that you need to understand about socially responsible AI is that it needs to follow some recognized code of ethics. And you have heard of what happens when AI hallucinates. Lawyers have been intimately aware now that they should check everything that comes out in before they put into them into their submissions. But also it has to be transparent and explainable, which I think is more difficult, both because the way that the black box works makes it difficult to explain, but also because the technology itself is difficult to explain. In the same way that the tablets made technology in the computer accessible to, say, seniors or children, we need to think about how do you make AI both understandable but also trusted. And that means that there needs to be conversations that are already taking place between industry and government across governments and have a code of safety, but also a code of conduct that ensures that when you enter the algorithm, you enter the system, you know that it's not going to come back and bite you.
Megan, you've worked with artists. So, you know, for creative expression, AI, generative AI can be a wonderful tool, but there's also, I think, as novelists, a Canadian novelist, I forget her name, but she said, my 30 novels were scraped by a bot, and now they could probably write as good a novel as I could without the spelling mistakes. So how are artists beginning to use AI as a tool, but also they're fearful of losing control over their work? What are you seeing?
Well, I think it's an uncertain space, and I think what we're seeing is kind of some quick evolution, although, you know, the Copyright Office has not been I think some recent registration decisions have not quite acknowledged the role that AI is playing as a tool. But, you know, as the technology, it is not sort of any surprise. Daryl mentioned the kind of the era of Napster and Grokster, Aimster, and et cetera. You know, it's no surprise that technology advances significantly faster than law. And so I think we're seeing kind of this amorphous space. I remember, you know, going to an event and listening to, during the Napster trials, listening to a lawyer talk about kind of this perfect digital master and how that would kind of transform the industry. I think we're seeing now sort of another type of tool that can both enhance creativity and also, you know, facilitate an infringement, you know, and so we've seen that in the Sony VCR and Betamax. We've seen, you know, it's sort of this is another step in that process. But certainly I think, you know, when it comes to the use of AI tools in the creative industry and then also the legal services industry, you know, there the potential is significant. And, you know, I think when it comes to adopting AI in the legal environment, you know, I've worked on some research lately with regard to the use of AI tools and education of students in law schools. And we're seeing kind of the legal services industry somewhat slow to adopt AI tools, in part because, you know, a lot of lawyers don't like taking risks. We're risk averse, and that law schools are also risk averse.
Are you concerned that some of your students may be using AI, relying on it too much? I mean, it's fine to use it as a tool, but how do you track, did it do 80% of that paper or did it just do 10% to get them started? You know, it's sort of, we're still in the wild west of, you know, determining those things. What's your thinking?
You know, my thinking is that students are going to be using these kinds of tools and that we need to, you know, that in kind of an all-out ban on the use of the tools is not particularly helpful. What we need to do is to figure out how to educate our students to use these tools in ways that are productive and enhance their ability to write. They can work on first drafts. There are all kinds of, you know, there are all kinds of ways that AI tools can help students be more successful, both in the classroom and then I think as lawyers when they graduate.
You're thinking, Daryl, how much generative AI bot is being used?
Well, I'll address your question at two levels. One, with respect to students, I think students are ahead of the curve as far as how quickly and easily they have adapted to it. I think the administrators at schools, professors, they are the ones that are a bit reticent. The reality is you can't hold back technology. So again, as linking to your earlier question about socially responsible AI, it's really how do you deploy it in a useful way? I'm very happy to hear that Megan is really doing that at Franklin Pierce. It's not that common that you see law schools being quite so nimble in being able to get into the game. With respect to attorneys, I was just giving a talk to the local bar in Cumberland County, and they are also deeply concerned about AI, but I think they were encouraged to hear that it is actually a game changer for small and medium law firms, because the one big advantage that big law has are economies of scale. But in a sense, you can do a lot with AI that paralegals can do, that junior associates can do with AI, and there are legal sector-specific AI tools that are being rolled out at a breathtaking pace. The key is to keep up with it, and I think this is again where the two sides need to have some kind of a broker to intersect, to interface with them, and to make it easy for both the students and the professors, and thinking ahead, the practitioners, to be able to use this tool, because you save so much time. You get really a chance to go up the value chain. And I think there are many opportunities there, again, for those who can tap onto it.
We're getting towards the end of our time. So a couple of more questions. This has been really enlightening. I thank you both. AI is sort of like the tail that's wagging the IP dog, if you will, because everybody has copyrights. So now you're concerned or aware that the bots are gobbling them up and regurgitating them in responses. There's not much transparency. Do you see engineers and business students focusing more on, if they focus on AI, they have to focus on IP?
Well, I don't think the two are necessarily coextensive. AI is a lot broader than IP, but IP is an important part of AI. In fact, when we think about IP these days, we think about data, we think about privacy. We don't just think about IP. It's a more complicated conversation. The ingredients that you think about are more diverse, but that's because the issues are more diverse and the people are more diverse. I mentioned Suzanne Harrison earlier. In fact, I should say that Suzanne appeared in the Profiles in Leadership series. So you can check it out if you want to hear what more she has to say about this issue. But I think there's a recognition that we need to think about IP in a strategic way. And part of that strategic way involves really interfacing with the world in a way which, as lawyers, we overlook. But she's not a lawyer by training, so she comes from it with the perspective already that we need to get to. And so with AI, I think you need to really think about interdisciplinary education. You need to think about how do you get the two sides that people in the engineering STEM programs, the legal education side of things, to work together from day one while they are still in law school, and to take advantage of technology like Zoom so that they don't necessarily have to be in the same place at the same time. And to think about externships, internships, how you can better integrate this understanding, appreciation of collaborative working, collaborative learning, and the idea that you need to keep on learning, not just about the law, but about how the law needs to remain relevant to the greater world. We are, at the end of the day, a service industry. You're only as good as the service that you provide. We're not there for our own sakes. And I think that sometimes that gets lost in thinking about the doctrine.
So many of the grand challenges that we face as a society are dependent upon intellectual property and understanding of IP rights. And IP is an essential part of that strategy, whether we're talking about, you know, we've certainly seen that through the pandemic in the healthcare industry and, you know, financial sector, environmental issues and climate change. One of the things we were talking earlier is about the global nature of IP. And as, you know, countries sort of emerge and develop into, from kind of old economy to new economy, innovation and a strong IP system really is critical, not just for the health of those economies, but also for U.S. national security, you know, issues of surrounding trade.
Diversity and inclusion too.
Absolutely. And, you know, and that's something that we've worked really, you know, strongly on at Franklin Pierce, with especially with our hybrid, mostly online JD in IP technology and information law, expanding IP education throughout law school, throughout business schools, throughout undergrad, and around the world, I think will benefit us as a society, and we should do more and more of that.
How do we make those concepts of IP, even the most basic ones, relevant? Because we have something on CIPU called ipbasics.org, and it's a kind of a portal to get more information about IP. And we labor over making it succinct and visual.
One of the things I do as I'm teaching IP in kind of undergrad and high schools, I will often show a very quick slideshow of from the moment they wake up in the morning and they grab their phone and hit snooze to, you know, kind of getting in their car, showing sort of how all the IP intersects with their actions in a given day, you know, as they stop by Starbucks, as they, whether it is the development of technology that they're using, whether it is, you know, a matter of entertainment, if it's a matter of the doctrine that they're studying in the course of their classrooms, you know, IP impacts every single area of our lives. It is sort of who we are as individuals. And so I think one way to help students understand that is to just reflect on their own experience and show that underneath sort of all of their actions and some of their thoughts on a daily basis, that there are IP legal frameworks interacting all the time.
Daryl, are you using any innovative materials, content that sort of gets through to not just lawyers, but to the public and others and business students and engineers?
Right. I think that's exactly the nub of it. So how do we reach more than our traditional base? The USIP Alliance has a 1 million student goal. So we want to teach 1 million students, reach out to them and have IP as part of their curriculum. Doesn't have to be a formal 15, 14, 13 week course, but on a regular basis, and they do this at Georgia Tech, they bring in practitioners, they bring in industry people to talk about IP. And so it's already embedded in their DNA that this is something that's important. People often come into law school with no idea of IP. And so they don't know that there are these opportunities until it's too late. So Finnegan, for example, a law firm in Washington, D.C., is doing that, focusing on underrepresented groups. I think it's really casting your net wider and earlier into the earlier stages of education. Michelson IP is doing that. MIT Lemelson is doing that. But we need more people because it's a big task. It's a big country. And we need to do it in a coherent way. So think about organizations, both at the national level, but also at the local level, that can really concentrate some of these efforts and share best practices. So this platform, Bruce, that you're providing, Megan and I, not just to talk to each other, but also to reach out to folks, I hope will catalyze the thinking in getting together, because much of this is going to be a ground-up effort, but it's so worth it because the future of this country lies in technology, lies in rewarding ideas, lies in having frank debates about why sometimes the processes in rewarding those ideas don't work. But if you think about the alternative, which is polarization, which is talking past each other, which you see, unfortunately, playing out before our eyes, not just politically in this country, but in parts of the world hotspots, it's terrifying. And so I think it's incumbent on those who know better, who've given the opportunity to make a difference, to do so.
Well, on that note, that was fantastic. Both of you, I think you've helped to, humanize IP somewhat for those who are less aware. I'm glad to see that you're both reaching out past law schools to share your knowledge and your techniques. Understanding IP Matters is brought to you by the Center for IP Understanding, an independent nonprofit. Follow CIPU on LinkedIn at the Center for Intellectual Property. Content conveyed is for informational purposes only and does not represent the views of CIPU or its affiliates. This episode was produced by Jack Shields for Wild Creek Studios.